Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 8. Sixth Hole. The sixth hole seemed to stretch on for a mile. It was actually about a third of a mile, the longest hole on the course, and perhaps the most difficult one to par, let alone birdie. With three strokes in the bank, Scott was well aware he could afford a bogey, or even a double, and still have a great round of golf. But boy, wouldn't it be great to par this one?
Mr. Hanover still has honors, announced the official.
It was an unnecessary announcement, but it gave the red-jacketed man something to do.
There will also be silence at the tee from the spectators, he added.
To the right, and at the distance of a decent drive, a water hazard teased the edge of the fairway. It was, in fact, an extension of the same pond Scott had escaped on the third hole, and he didn't want to give a ball to it on this one.
Oh, it doesn't bother me if they quack, said Scott.
Nonetheless, it bothers me, drawled the official, his voice falling down in pitch, the emphasis on me. Paul covered his mouth and coughed an inaudible insult at the man, but everyone knew what he said and managed to stifle their chuckles.
There will be no more talking while players are getting ready to hit or are hitting, added the official.
Scott shrugged his shoulders. He glanced at the camera woman, and she gave a consolatory smile. She mouthed a quack, and Scott smiled. It wasn't the same, but he didn't need to be on the official's bad side. He set up his ball and pulled his cap down a little to reduce the glare coming from the sun which they were now facing. It would continue to be in his eyes for the next three holes as they made their way back to the clubhouse. He took a couple of practice swings, concentrating on keeping the swing controlled and steady. The water pulled at his eyes, and something felt wrong. He looked at his feet. He scrunched his face, and without thinking about how amateurish it might look, he laid his club on the ground so that the head was at his left toe and the handle at his right toe. Then he stepped back and looked to where the shaft of the club was pointed. It was aimed straight for the water hazard to the right. He looked at Paul.
I wanted to say something, but I didn't want you to get penalized by Hitler there, he muttered.
It's okay, said Scott. I knew it didn't feel right. He left the club on the ground, but redirected it so it now pointed down the left side of the fairway. Then he realigned his toes along the shaft before picking up the club. It was a trick he had learned when he first started golfing. The line your toes made always pointed to where the ball would go, if you hit it well. With his tendency to add a little slice to his drives, he felt confident that he'd keep it in the fairway now.
"Are you ready, Mr. Hanover?" growled the official.
Scott glared at him.
"I would appreciate it," he said, directing his stare into the red-jacketed man's eyes, "if there was no talking right now." The man gasped and sputtered and realized he had just broken his own rule. He tried to return Scott's glare, but simply nodded and averted his eyes from Scott's with a degree of unease that made Scott smile, a smile that was not unappreciated by others around the tee. He took another couple of practice swings, more to irk the official than out of need, and stepped up to the ball once more. He eyed his imaginary target in the fairway and drew the club back. His wrists cocked. He seemed to hold the backswing longer than usual, but it couldn't have been that long. He brought it around with a sensation of perfection, twisted his body in the follow-through, and found himself staring straight into the sun, with no idea where the ball was. He tilted his head down, but his vision was covered with blue-white globs, forming an amoeba pattern in front of his eyes. He gazed at the fairway, looking for the ball to come down, but only saw white patches surrounded by darkness. His ball could have gone anywhere. Left, right, into the water? He had no idea. He turned behind him and was able to make out Paul squinting into the sunlight. Paul's right hand came up, and he pointed out into the fairway. "Wow," he said. "That was up a long time." "Where is it?" asked Scott. "Right in the middle. You really got a hold of it." "In the middle?" Scott asked incredulously. "You'll see it. Just walk straight out." Jerry shook his head. He had missed the shot in the sun as well, and took Paul's word that Scott had nailed a decent drive. He stepped up to the tee with his own driver to take his turn at the hole. Scott was able to follow Jerry's shot and watched it dribble along the right side of the fairway, stopping even with the inmost edge of the water hazard, but still on the nicely cut fairway. "Nice shot," he commented. Jerry smiled, and Pete took his place at the tee. Pete was a little hesitant as he set his ball and squinted out into the sun. He lined himself up, an expression of trepidation on his face. As Pete swung, Scott could tell the previous hole had gotten to him. His swing was off, and the shot hooked far to the left. It landed past a line of trees, hopefully in a decent position where he might have a shot out of the rough. His frustration was not expressed by pounding the ground with his club, as Jerry had resorted to earlier, but with his palm placed over his brow and eyes, rubbing with deliberation. He seemed to be trying to figure out what he had done wrong, not realizing it wasn't his swing that was off, but his mindset. He needed to get over the last hole before he could get his regular game back. Scott continued to blink away the retinal burns, and as they walked along the fairway, Pete and his caddy broke off to the left and Jerry to his right. "See it?" asked Paul, pointing again. Scott shook his head. There were too many pieces of debris that looked like balls. "You're gonna like it," Paul said. Pete's caddy found his ball. It was perhaps 1 yard from the tree line that gave way to a fence along 159th Street to the north. He wouldn't have a full swing, so his only chance was to lay it up back onto the fairway and hope for a good third shot. Pete didn't look too happy with the results of his drive. He looked at Scott and Paul far up in the middle of the fairway and shook his head, muttering something neither could hear. Scott was still straining to see his ball, and was concerned Paul hadn't really got a good look at it coming off the tee. Maybe Paul had imagined his ball in the fairway. For all Scott knew, it had landed in the woods or the pond. He looked back over at Pete. Pete tested how far he could take a backswing before receiving interference from the tall weeds and shrubs at the edge of the trees. It wasn't much. He punched at the ball and got it out, but it only rolled about 5 or 6 yards and was still in the rough. "Closer to the hole," muttered Paul and Scott. Pete did not appear to be looking at the glass half full at this time. He walked to the new ball position, ready to kill it if necessary. He hacked at it with the same over-effort that had landed his drive in a bad spot, and the ball soared straight across the fairway to land in the rough on the opposite side, perhaps 190 yards from the green. Once again, Pete's anger showed. He swung again at where his ball had been, as if not sure what had gone wrong. Jerry had watched the whole show from the other side of the fairway and shrugged it off. He'd had his terror hole and could remember the feeling of frustration, but also the relief as he let it go and started to have fun. He swung, and the sound of the well-hit ball echoed along the fairway. The ball stayed fairly low, but rolled quite a distance before stopping about even with Pete's. It was still nicely in the middle of the fairway instead of buried in the rough. "Let's go," urged Paul. Scott blindly followed him, still not certain where his drive had landed. They were practically on top of the ball before Scott saw it. He turned to look back at the tee, then at the hole. He had to be a little better than halfway along the longest hole on the course. "I put it at about 300 yards.
I told you you'd like it."
Paul pulled an iron from the bag and handed it to Scott. "I hit that drive 300 yards?" Scott asked in disbelief. He bent closer to the ball and could make out part of the Yellow Duck logo, stamped over the dimpled surface.
"Right in the middle of the club," Paul said. "It was perfect."
"Wow.
Wow,"
echoed Paul. Scott looked at the club Paul had handed him.
"My 9-iron? Well, I know your fairway woods aren't going 270 yards, and there are sand traps all along the front of the green. Get it about 125 yards from the hole, and then you can put it in the middle of the green with your pitching wedge. It's smart course management," added Paul.
Scott thought about it.
"But I could knock it up 200 yards with my 5-wood and then just have a 70-yard chip to get it on."
"You're better off using a full swing club to get on the green, Scott. Trust me. Your low irons hit very straight, and there are traps on the back of the green too, remember?"
"Yeah."
"Trust me, Scott," he repeated.
Scott took the club and smiled.
"Okay," he agreed. He carefully lined up his shot and stood still over the ball for a moment. This was usually the time he tried not to think. His usual pattern, after having a great drive, was to flub the next shot or two and end up bogeying or double bogeying the hole. He knew he could afford a bogey or two on the front nine, but if only he could turn this great drive into something. Paul noticed Scott's apprehension.
"Scott, hit the ball. It goes where it goes."
"That's true," Scott thought. Who was he to think that he could control the tiny object? There were a million different outcomes from every swing. Some of them good, some bad. You took what you got. If this shot were bad, he'd still have one more chance to get on the green. If not, then he could still be on in 4 and, with a good putt, par the hole. He breathed out and let the club sit on the ground behind the ball, the grip hanging loosely in his left hand. He grabbed it firmly and wrapped his right hand below the left on the shaft.
"What about a practice swing?"
"No, not this time," he told himself. "Not this swing." The club glided back smoothly along the shortcut fairway, and his left shoulder dipped under his chin as his club lifted over his head. His arms stopped moving, but his hands twisted a little more back, cocking the wrists. With surety and determination, he swung for the spot in front of the ball, his body unwinding like a watch spring popped free. There was no divot like the one he saw when a pro golfer took a swing, but a bare patch of dirt with short stumps of grass appeared in front of where the ball had been. Scott once again lost sight of his shot to the glare of the sun. He turned his attention towards the hole and waited for it to drop. After what seemed like too long, it fell 150 yards directly in front of him and bounced once.
"There you go," said Paul, as if he had no doubt whatsoever.
Pete Baldwin shook his head, and Jerry Spalding nodded. Scott just smiled. Pete walked to his ball, and it was evident from his stance he was still frustrated with how he was playing the hole, especially after his last hole. Scott wouldn't be surprised if Pete flubbed the next shot, and he did. The ball landed smack dab in the middle of the sand trap on the right side in front of the green. With more anger than common sense, he tossed his club back over his shoulder before realizing the pond on the left side of the fairway was nearly directly behind him. The club splashed in the water 3 or 4 yards from the edge of the pond. His caddy was trying to keep from laughing until Pete walked up to him and spoke an order into his ear. The caddy shook his head violently at first. Pete spoke to him some more. Scott could tell the caddy had closed his eyes and was considering what his boss had just told him to do. After contemplating his options, he removed his socks and shoes and rolled up his pants almost to his groin. Scott and Paul watched as the caddy stepped into the pond and waded out, feeling with his foot on the slimy bottom. The look on his face was pure disgust. Within a few seconds, however, it turned to triumph, and he lifted a club up with his foot and pulled it up out of the water. Then, for some reason, the smile faded as he tossed the club on the fairway and kept searching.
"It was the wrong club," laughed Paul. "Oh my God, do you think Pete's played here before?" asked Scott.
Paul lost it, and his laughs earned a glare from Pete, who was across the fairway. Paul immediately tried to stifle it, but the chuckles turned to tears on his face and his upper body convulsed with swallowed mirth. Within another 20 seconds, Pete's caddy's foot found another golf club in the murk, and this time it was Pete's. He waded to shore and climbed out, wiping mud from his feet and checking for leeches as he shivered in the cold air. Jerry had been enjoying the show as well, and after the club had been successfully recovered, he set up his shot. He went for the green, and from where Scott and Paul stood, probably made it. It was impossible to see the green, as mounds of grass covered earth in front of the sand trap allowed only the top of the flagstick to be visible. Jerry looked over at the pair and shrugged. Their guess was as good as his. The majority of the observers shadowing the threesome were a few yards behind Scott and followed him as he walked up to his ball. He passed the white 150-yard marker and could see the red 100-yard marker flush on the ground ahead of him. He was dead in the middle of the two, perfect for his pitching wedge, as Paul had promised.
"Course management, eh?" commented Scott.
"Course management," said Paul.
"Is there some course for that?" joked Scott.
"Yeah, but you have to take divot repair as a prerequisite."
"Gotcha."
This time, Scott did take one practice swing, adjusting to the slightly shorter shaft of the club. If he could line the ball on or near the green and stay out of the sand, he might par this one. He still couldn't see the green clearly, but Paul assured him all he had to do was to aim at the flagstick, which he did. He didn't hold back, but he didn't put any extra effort into the swing either. He just hoped it would go straight. For the third time, he found himself staring into the blinding sun. He looked for and found the flagstick poking up and hoped his ball would fall somewhere in that vicinity. For a moment, he was sure the ball had shanked to the left or right, because nothing was coming down where he hoped. Then there was an almost audible whistle, like a bomb falling from the sky along with a thump, as he saw his ball come down just to the right of the stick. How far forward or back, he couldn't tell. He almost didn't want to go up and look. The watchers behind him started passing him, and he walked up slowly, excited but afraid. He had lost his depth perception in the blinding rays of the sun. It was possible what he heard was the ball landing in sand on the opposite side of the green. With the distance he was getting off his clubs today, that was entirely possible. Ellie, the camera woman, was the first one to crest the mounds in front of the green, and she turned to face Scott. She was smiling and gave him the thumbs up. Then she held her two hands about a foot apart in front of her face. Scott stopped and shook his head. She vehemently nodded, and her smile grew. Pete had also reached a mound, and his reaction confirmed Ellie's report. He stood there shaking his head from side to side, muttering something under his breath. He walked back down, took his sand wedge to his ball in the sand trap. He punched it out neatly thanks to his practice on the last hole and walked off while his caddy smoothed the trap. Scott reached the mound and looked at the situation below him. The flagstick was pretty much in the middle of the green, which had a downhill slant from the left front corner to the back right. One ball was about a foot to the right of the hole, and Scott assumed that was his. Jerry's ball was just off the green on the fringe, 7 yards from the hole, but puttable. Pete's was 5 yards from the hole in front of the pin. Scott's eyes returned to where his ball sat. "Don't miss this one," he told himself. "Don't miss it." He had missed 1-foot putts before, and he wasn't going to take this one for granted. He walked down and placed his tiny penny behind his ball and picked it up. He realized it was the same ball he had started with 6 holes earlier. How often did that happen with this much water on a course? The answer was never. Pete marked his ball with a quarter and Jerry set up his putt. He hit it straight and for a moment it looked like it would make it, but it died a few inches from the hole. He walked up and knocked in an easy par and pulled his ball out. Applause rippled from the onlookers, and Paul and Scott joined them. Pete took his time reading the green. His caddy stood back, obviously angry with Pete for making him wade through muck and not about to offer any advice on the putt. Pete's putt missed the left side of the hole and ended up a foot away. He walked up, took a second to aim, and knocked his 7th shot in the hole. A double bogey. A courteous round of applause accompanied the effort, which Pete ignored. Scott placed his ball back on the ground and picked up his penny. He slid it into his pocket and rubbed its rough surface between his fingers, remembering how it came to be his ball marker. Sarah and Scott had taken a vacation to the Cayman Islands for their 2nd anniversary. Sarah had strictly forbidden him from taking his clubs with them, and was determined they would have a romantic getaway. Unfortunately, their 2nd day there, the previous night's dinner of jerk chicken decided to wreak havoc on Sarah's stomach, and she ended up confined to bed with occasional trips to the bathroom. Scott tried his best to make her comfortable, but she quickly grew frustrated and annoyed with his well-intended attention. With a sigh and great reluctance, she suggested he go out and play some golf. He asked if she was sure, and she shooed him out of the room before she could change her mind. Scott had the concierge in the hotel book him a tee time at a local course and arrange for a club rental. When he reached the golf course, he bought a couple sleeves of balls, some tees, and a Titleist glove, putting the whole tab on his credit card. He found himself grouped with a very nice Canadian couple who played the course several times a week and assured Scott that he would find it challenging and fun. It wasn't until the first green that he realized his regular ball marker was back in his own golf bag in Chicago. One of the Canadians gave him a tiny, bright, coppery Cayman Islands 1-cent piece to use. He ended up shooting poorly, but did have fun. When he returned to their hotel room that evening, Sarah was sleeping. He quietly emptied his pockets on the nightstand, placing his 2 remaining golf balls on top of the slightly used golf club to keep them from rolling off, and his penny on the table, and slipped into bed next to Sarah. The next day, Sarah was feeling normal again. She noticed the penny on the table, and Scott explained how it had come to be his ball marker. "If that's all you have to show for your afternoon, it seems like it turned out to be a pretty expensive penny," she commented. Scott chuckled. "I didn't look at it that way. I should hold on to it then." "I would expect so," she joked. From then on, that coin had been in the pocket of his golf bag. Now, as he let the tiny coin slip from his fingers into his pocket, he remembered that vacation. How Sarah had not made Scott suffer along with her that afternoon. How she had lifted her ban on golf during what was supposed to be their romantic getaway, even though Scott would have gladly stayed with her. He knew that wouldn't be happening after the baby came. Scott crouched down behind the ball to verify it was a straight shot to the hole, then set his stance. He adjusted his putter so the lines on the back pointed along the path he wanted the ball to take. "Just don't leave it short," he prayed. It was an easy shot, a gimme as many casual golfers would play it. They would just pick up the ball, assuming it would go in with one shot. Yet Scott had missed his share of one-footers and even seen pros miss them too. Scott never liked to take a gimme, even when playing just for fun. He believed there were no gimmies in life. You had to follow through on every task you started. What's more, he loved the sound of the ball falling in the plastic cup. It was music to his ears, even after a particularly bad hole. He pulled the club back 3 inches and pushed it into the ball. The duck emblazoned ball rolled for the hole and dropped straight in, the clunking sound confirming he had done it again. Another birdie. He was now 4 strokes under par. It was unbelievable. The applause was more than courteous this time, and Scott pulled the ball out and clenched it in his fist. What a day. What a day. Jason stared at the television screen in disbelief. Eric Gunther, the high school runner who had been leading the Chicago Marathon for over half its length, was dying. His pace had dropped precipitously, and many were speculating he was injured. The group of Kenyans and other top runners were about to pass him, and several did as he slowed to a walk. Well, thought Jason, that'll certainly make for an interesting story. He had envisioned hours of coverage for the teenager if he actually won, but as a fader, or worse, a non-finisher, he might briefly be featured in the commentary of the race. Perhaps his little golf tournament might make a report after all. He had mixed feelings regarding this. It meant having to actually edit the tape, and it sounded like Ellie was getting plenty. But maybe it wouldn't be the punishment he thought it was. He glanced out at the scorecard. Hanover had hit a 4 on his last hole, a par 5. What did that make him, 3 or 4 under par? 4, said the scoreboard. He had 3 holes to finish for the front half of the course. No one else was close. There were a few 1-under pars, but most of the early players were shooting several strokes over. He realized that the good golfers would tee off last, so he wondered if Hanover's score would hold up. If it did, and he pulled off an upset from dead last, it would be the Eric Gunther story, but with a happier ending. Of course, he could also fade on the back half of the course and he'd have nothing. But maybe. It wasn't worth getting excited over at this point. He'd relax in the clubhouse and maybe get one of those donuts he'd seen at the courtesy breakfast table for players, officials, and guests. He was a guest, wasn't he? The chirp of his cell phone interrupted his thought and drew a few stares from others. He'd have to switch it to silent mode. The caller ID display read number not available. It couldn't be the camera woman again. Her extension showed up last time. His wife didn't have this number. It had to be someone from the affiliate office.
Bernard here, he answered.
Bernard, what's with this Hanover? He going to make a run at it?
Jason was startled to hear the voice on the other end. It was Harold Frisk, head of the Chicago affiliate office of USA Sports. He started to answer, but Frisk cut him off.
You heard about the marathon, eh? Heck, you're probably watching it at the clubhouse right now with some coffee and donuts.
Yes, sir. I mean, he's doing well, but he's ranked last, so he could just be having a good run right now and fade later.
Your camera woman thinks he's doing well and can keep it up.
Jason fumed. That girl had gone behind his back. Frisk probably golfed 3 or 4 times a week. I was planning on meeting up with her after the first 9 and seeing if we have anything to use. But the best golfers haven't teed off yet.
I don't care about the best golfers,
interrupted Frisk.
I lost my high school kid, and now they're saying he was taking some sort of performance-enhancing drug. It may have had some cardiac problem. I need my story for tonight. With the Bulls and the Bears off and no baseball teams in the playoffs, I need a big local story. Heck, if he pulls it off, we may take it national. You would take it national, Bernard.
Yes, sir.
Call when he finishes the front 9.
What about Andrew Patterson?
What?
He's the favorite and top amateur in the area.
Never bet the favorite, my boy. Can't make money betting the favorite. But get some tape just in case. You know, him playing, what he thinks of Hanover.
Right, Hanover.
just get it, Bernard.
Jason waited to make sure the connection was discontinued and hung up. He remembered to turn on the vibrate mode and slipped it into his pocket. The word national kept going through his mind. If the story was picked up nationally, it would be a huge break. Maybe this golf thing wasn't so bad after all. He turned his attention to the scoreboard and looked at the information for the seventh hole. It was a par three. Jason Bernard found himself a little excited now. Was he actually beginning to get interested in a golf event? If someone had told him that this morning, he'd have laughed. Andrew Patterson slipped his unlit, cold, and empty pipe into his trouser pocket as he walked slowly toward the clubhouse. He'd find Eric Peters, hit a few dozen balls, and get ready for his tee off. He patted the breast pocket under his sweater where the contract was tucked. Recognition and fame lay ahead. He needed it not to get to him. He still had a round of golf to play. There was a crowd at the scoreboard. Soon enough, his name would be at the top of the leaderboard, a scene that might appear in a television commercial someday soon. Andrew sensed the morning warming up. Some light clouds to the west were breaking up as the burning sun in the east rose higher in the bright blue sky. In a few more weeks, the leaves would fall from the trees and begin to litter the fairways with additional hiding places for errant shots. But that was not a worry today. Today was Andrew Patterson Day, and in a few hours, everyone here would know it. As he made his way past the line of parked golf carts, Andrew shuddered. The noisy, infernal machines had always annoyed him. More than once he found his concentration destroyed by their engines sputtering as their lazy occupants raced to the next shot. Carts, he thought, ruined the game, and defeated the whole purpose of it being a sport. Why play golf if you didn't want to get any exercise? What was everyone in such a hurry for, anyway? And who drove these carts? Often it was the older men with pot bellies who could barely lift their overstuffed gigantic golf bags into the back of the cart, let alone carry them on the course. Andrew usually carried his own bag when he played practice rounds. He used a caddy when he needed one, but he enjoyed the invigorating feel of walking 4 or more miles along the crisply cut fairways and greens, along the sparkling ponds and streams, and through the sprawling and unforgiving trees. Today, Eric Peters would carry his bag. If he performed well, he'd take him to the Pro-Am contest in a couple of weeks. Maybe he'd even get to be in Andrew's commercials. But it was more likely that the ad agency would insist on an actor or perhaps an actress to play the supporting role. "Hi," interrupted an artificially upbeat and insincerely cheery voice.
"I've heard a lot about you, Mr. Patterson."
The man extended a soft, plump, nicotine-stained hand. Andrew looked at the hand and smiled. "All good, I hope," he joked. The hand fell away in the embarrassment of rejection.
"They say you're the man to beat, and I'm willing to bet they're right."
Something about the man's demeanor and approach was vaguely familiar. Had he met this man before? Certainly he'd have remembered such a shabbily clad character in any incarnation. "Can I help you?" prompted Andrew.
"Well, it's more like I can help you," pitched the man. "My name is Jake Fisher, and I'm an agent with Fraser and Frakes."
Jake had replaced his coat and tie, and even flattened down a few stray hairs with his palm to prepare for the meeting. Ah, realized Andrew, the man Karen had spoken of. His manner was similar to hers. The patronizing words and fake smile were nice to see, but transparent to their real motives. These agents were out for money. If they wanted to make Andrew a few bucks along the way, so be it. Andrew was beginning to feel a little flattered that so many people were after his attention. But after evaluating his first impression of this Fisher fellow, he was happy that Miss Blakely had found him first. "How interesting," Andrew said. "It seems that I am very popular among your ilk today."
"My ilk?"
asked Jake Fisher, very confused. He was pulling a folded stack of papers from his jacket pocket. a set that looked very familiar to Andrew. They seemed identical to those Karen had in her purse for him to sign.
Yes, you wouldn't happen to know a Miss Karen Blakely, would you?
I do, answered Jake cautiously, not willing to admit that somehow he was too late after all. But he knew what was coming before Andrew Patterson said it, and his mind was melting into confusion. He had sent Karen to the marathon.
She's already signed to me. She has big plans, you know. Well, I'd say it was a pleasure to meet you, but it wouldn't be true, blathered Andrew inconsiderately.
Good day to you. As he started past the agent, Jake inexplicably began to laugh. Andrew stopped and turned.
Did I say something funny, Mr. Fisher?
Funny?
Asked Jake. You're laughing.
Oh, it's not you, personally. Although,
Jake let his eyes roam up and down Patterson as he toned his laugh into a chuckle.
I see, grumbled Patterson.
Mr. Patterson, you don't know me. You don't know where I am or where I've been. But I know you. To tell you the truth, this is actually a bit of a relief. Believe me when I wish you luck in your endeavors with Miss Blakely.
Well, better luck next time, Andrew said with no conviction as he started off in search of Eric Peters.
That's that, said Jake out loud after Patterson was out of earshot.
He had tried, but Karen had somehow found Patterson before him, and thanks to Jake, she was on her way to the marathon and possibly a second big contract. He knew Jonathan and Gina would understand. But how was he going to take this failure and turn it into something good? A murmur spread through the crowd at the scoreboard. Jake walked over and noticed the man in the yellow slacks and shirt was hanging scorecards for the first group at the seventh hole. He still couldn't see the score from where he was and walked closer, pushing politely through the crowd. Anna and Sarah waded into the crowded rummage sale. Even this late in the morning, the place was still a madhouse. Anna was looking for a sofa to replace the torn and sagging one that her husband had brought with him into the marriage. Dale would not be pleased by the change. He claimed the cushions conformed ideally to his body shape and ensured maximum comfort while watching television. Sarah hoped to find a glider rocker. She imagined herself nursing her new baby, listening to a CD while the tender infant snuggled in for a meal, the chair softly carrying them into a peaceful relaxation. A jolt from a tweed-coated woman woke Sarah from her daydream, and the woman bustled off without an apology.
How rude, commented Sarah.
It's definitely a Darwinian sale, her sister observed. The most aggressive shoppers will get the merchandise and the weak will be left holding a pink flamingo lawn ornament when it's all said and done.
Glider rocker, Sarah said, focused on her mission. They pushed to the middle of the basement where the living room furniture could be found. Eventually they reached the narrow rows of chairs and couches. Many of the items were adorned with bright orange sold signs. There were three glider rockers unclaimed. One was particularly well-worn but comfortable. Another didn't glide, but claimed to need only minor repairs that any handyman or handywoman, thought Sarah, fresh from her crib assembly, could tackle. But the last one seemed just right. It was oak, with large, overstuffed cushions on the seat and back, and was accompanied by a large rocking footstool as well. She ran her hands over its surface, feeling the glossy finish of the wood and the soft, inviting feel of the cushions.
Sit on it, Anna encouraged.
Sarah did so, and immediately found herself gliding in the comfortable chair, rocking softly, lulled into her daydream with more vividness than before.
It's a bargain at $250, said a rummage sale volunteer with Cecily written boldly on her name tag. I've seen the same chair in the department stores for $800 with the stool, she added.
It's nice, answered Sarah noncommittally. I'm really just looking.
Suit yourself, retorted Cecily, who huffed off to assist another interested buyer, a young man looking at a leather recliner.
It's a little high, commented Anna.
but it's so nice. But you're right. Scott would kill me if I bought it. Hey, he's out golfing, right? Well, maybe they'll mark it down a little. Perhaps I should get that woman back and see if they'll bargain.
Before she could get up, another woman with Sally written on her name tag approached.
Interested in the chair? She asked.
Possibly, interrupted Anna, knowing Sarah's answer would give away her desire for the chair.
But it does seem rather expensive for a rummage sale. I know it's for charity, but...
Sally looked at the tag and shook her head. Cecily must have changed this, she said. No wonder someone else hasn't taken it yet.
She pulled a thick black magic marker from her pocket and crossed out the two in the price.
Are you serious? Sarah asked.
It's great for nursing, she answered, nodding at Sarah's distended abdomen.
So I'm told. You seem to like it. It's yours for 50.
Sold, agreed Sarah. She pulled herself up out of the rocker.
The stool too?
Absolutely, smiled Sally.
Sarah smiled back. Within 5 minutes, she had made a purchase even her penny-pinching husband would be proud of.
Is there anything else I can help you with?
I'm looking for a sofa, answered Anna.
Let's look around. There are a few nice ones left.
As they followed Sally and worked their way down the aisle, Sarah was surprised to see the young man handing Cecily $200 bills for the recliner. It wasn't in great shape, but it was obvious it wasn't the recliner's shape he was interested in.
She has her uses, Sally whispered as they walked by.
Anna and Sarah smiled at the remark.
A row of televisions were tuned to the local USA Sports Network affiliate as the coverage of the Chicago Marathon played over the screen.
Sarah thought she heard something about a kid using performance-enhancing drugs and nearly dying halfway through the race. A clock in the upper corner of the screen marked off the time elapsed for the lead runner, a very dark, tall, thin man, apparently from Kenya. As he ran, he grabbed water cups, drank some, and doused himself with others.
His thin frame seemed like it didn't have the endurance to run over 26 miles, but it was probably his light weight that contributed to his body's ability to accomplish such a grueling task with ease. At times, the camera showed other runners, none in competition with anyone but themselves, trying to finish a race they may only run once in their lives, just to be able to say they did it.
Many had a leisurely jogging pace. Some were even speed walking, while others were draped over the arms of their supporters, weeping at the cruelty of an unexpected injury or a cramp, or the realization that today would not be the day they completed a marathon. Sarah thought that maybe there were such things as marathon widows, and perhaps widowers, to go along with golf widows. There were people who loved to run more than anything else in the world, and when they ran, they were in a different world. Was that how it was for Scott? She had never thought of it that way. She had, at times, been grateful to get rid of him for a while, but she never really thought about what his golfing did for him. She hoped he was having fun and not doing too badly. She knew he would be happy to simply not be the last place finisher in the field, and Paul was there to keep him from getting too serious. She was happy with her chair, and was sure Scott would be excited for her too. First the crib, now the glider rocker. What a great day it was turning out to be. She turned and saw that Anna and Sally were quite a bit ahead of her, since she had been distracted by the televisions. As she started after them, another contraction grabbed her attention. She had been having mild ones every 10 or 15 minutes all morning. They had become a simple annoyance as she got used to them. Her doctor had told her to expect them from time to time as her uterus exercised in preparation for the big day. This one, however, caused her to stop. She breathed in slowly and let the tightness gradually fade away. Did it mean anything that this contraction was stronger than the previous ones? When she and Anna left the rummage sale, she would call her doctor. It wouldn't hurt to get an opinion, and it would put her mind at ease if the doctor told her it was nothing to worry about. She was glad she had accomplished 2 major tasks today. Now, if Anna could get a new sofa, that would be the icing on the cake.
Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you are interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries about a Crime-Solving Veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.